Accession number 18463, reel 31.
At reel 31.
Yeah, the company commander was talking to a major who I didn't recognise, but I thought might be the new company commander of D Company, and I think it probably was Major Nolder, possibly him. And the other chap was holding forth and saying that to the company commander, to Major Allen, well, of course, you can't fight a battle by sitting in a tent in the valley. And I thought, hello, he's talking about the CO, because that's, he had a bell tent and he was down in the valley. Of course, Colonel Mann and Major Gwynne had always been up round the forefront, seeing what was going on and, you know, judging things that they could see. So I guess that the company commanders were not all that pleased with their new commanding officer. It didn't mean much to me. And in fact, when I went back, I didn't tell anybody because I thought this is a private matter between them. But they kept me waiting there for a bit whilst they continued their conversation. They certainly weren't trying to whisper or anything like that. Major Allen then asked me what I'd found, told him about the stores and what have you, and suggested perhaps we could get our ammo back. And he said, yeah, okay. And we went back to the trench line again. And we were getting a little bit bored by this time, I think, because Nicky came over and said there was a Bangalore torpedo which had been buried. They're about 6 feet long. Well, they could be 8 feet long, of course, but I guess this was about 6 feet long. And it had been buried 3 feet in the ground, and it had been stamped into the ground there. And it was obvious that the striker on the top was a little string, and it was obvious the Chinese hoped that you'd go and pull this string and the darn thing would go off. Well, look, I guess if you were pretty stupid, you might do that, but we were well aware what it was. Nick said, how about setting that off? Well, I don't know. I'm getting a bit bored with life, so we looked around, found a bit of wire, and we wrapped it round the pipe in a hope that we could pull it out the ground, and the striker obviously would be fastened off in the bottom, and the darn thing would go off. It's a stupid thing to do, because I mean, people were sitting around all around us, you know, within about, I don't know, 20 or 30 feet away. So we tied this wire on the round the pipe, which was a shiny aluminium pipe about, I guess, 2 inches across, something like that. And then we went to get in the trench, the one that was full of grenades, which we hadn't actually got into before. And there was a little step at one end, and we didn't use a step. We jumped in on top of the grenades, because they won't go off, you know. You can knock them about a bit till you get really rough with them. And we're crouching down there, and suddenly I saw something shining in the step, metal shining in the step. Thankful we didn't come down by the step, because what they dug, crafty old sausages, they buried a larger grenade. There was another one, but it was about 3 inches across, I guess, and about 4 inches long with a stick. And they buried this lever down, and presumably pulled the pin out of it. And they buried it in the step, because if you stepped in on the edge of the step, it would have gone off after the fuse, you know, gone off. So we moved a little bit away from the step, gave the wire a great yank, and it didn't do anything. All it did, it shot up this shiny pipe and pulled the end cap off. And there we could see the striker and the little bit of cord that was wrapped to it. So I said to Nick, well, I think we've gone far enough with this, don't you? So we left it there again. Stupid thing to do. I mean, it was really a stupid thing to do. But you get so careless with things that you do silly things like that. You know, as I think I might have said earlier on the Nacton, my friend used to throw grenades down the wells as you were washing, and you'd hear a plop, and if you didn't dart back quick enough, you'd get showered with water and anything else that came up. So young men get careless. Anyway, we left this alone then, and decided that we wouldn't take it any further. And he went off, and I went off on a little recce of my own, and climbed. It was very, very steep on the right flank of my position, and there was water coming down. In fact, we were collecting water from I wouldn't call it a stream, a trickle of water coming from higher up on Cod. And I thought, well, I'll, you know, always been interested in nature. I'll find out where this is coming from. So I followed it up and found out exactly where it was coming from. It was literally springing out the side, about, oh, I go 10 feet below the crest, which Acomber, or a bit more than that maybe. It was springing out the side of the hill, just like a tap turned off, and trickling down, and of course eventually going into the main stream, which was down the bottom. Pure water it was, beautiful, cold. It was just by a Chinese dugout, one of the small dugouts, a real Chinese dugout. And I had a look around in that, and it was full of 4-5 ammunition, gun metal. I'd not seen that type before, made of gun metal. And also safe conduct passes, Chinese safe conduct passes, and I took a great bundle of them. I still got some of them now, and took them back and distributed them around to the lads. And the ammunition I gave to the people who got 4-5s, although later they told me it wouldn't fire in a 4-5 pistol. So I don't know whether maybe it was some dud stuff they'd left behind, because they weren't inclined to leave ammunition much, or whether it was perhaps because it was the gunmetal case and not brass. But it wouldn't go in, it wouldn't fire in 4-5 pistols. And we got word then that the ROCs were going to take over, 6th Div, the ROC 6th Division was going to take over from us, and they were sending parties up. And the first party that came up was an officer with the great big shiny map case, and we were all eyeing him up because he had a 4-5 pistol. We were always after 4-5 pistols, and people are saying, oh, if he gets shot, I'm going to have that pistol, you know, with his shiny map case and his crayons and things. And he had two or three guys around him, you know, private soldiers around him, and they cleared off and went off again. And another lot came up shortly after that with the old map board again. These map boards were, I guess, about a metre square, great shiny thing. So I suppose they were the staff or intelligence officers or something like that. They all had, obviously had guards with them, all reasonably smartly dressed, which was pretty unusual for ROCs. We got word that we were going to be relieved the following day. It's all gone quiet now, incidentally. The Chinese seem to have withdrawn from all around. And there's a bit of artillery fire now and again, but I think it was really only to sort of shake them up a bit and keep them on their way. And the following morning, they were supposed to relieve us just after stand to, but they didn't arrive in time. And I guess it was about 1100 or something like that when we started to move out off down the hill. And it was a bit embarrassing, really, because the platoon commander and the platoon sergeant, who were new, of course, and just had their first battle, for the platoon commander, his very first, and of course the other chap was a Second War veteran. And the new lads, they were jumping about all over the place and quite excited by it all, you know, being relieved. And they started to run down the hill, and we tried to stop them. But they just ran down the hill, and we were a bit embarrassed by this, because we never did this sort of thing, with the platoon commander ahead whooping and shouting, and the platoon sergeant shouting out to us that lazy gits, you know, get a move on and all that sort of thing. But we got down the bottom hoping that nobody had seen us. On the way down, we passed I can't remember if they were mules or donkeys, but something like that, with the ROC mortars on the back of them. They were just sitting around waiting, presumably, to go forward. We didn't see many ROCs, funny enough, and got down the bottom of the hill. And we then had a long march, and the platoon commander didn't say anything, but platoon sergeant was berating us for, you know, for being last, and, you know, not whooping and shouting and acting like a load of schoolboys. And we began a long march, and a good many miles, I guess. I think we were about 10 miles from where we started from, and we got to march back to at least part of that way to pick up the transport. And it got a bit tiresome, this march. And I got a picture. We came to a place in the road where this little stream went across, and I got a sort of sideways view of platoon HQ, which really only considered the platoon commander, wireless operator, platoon sergeant. I think there might have been one other. There were no batmen or mortarmen, and we hadn't got the mortar this time. Or if we had, I didn't notice it. And I got this picture of a chap named Bob Gilbertson, who I see regularly now. He was loaded down. Yes, he did have the mortar, that's right, yes. He had the radio, his rifle, the two-inch mortar, and the six bombs in the case there, and he was sagging forward and trudging on with his old head down, and I thought, well, the old one, they still keep going, don't they? And just at that moment, a jeep came round the corner, and the platoon sergeant, who'd been berating us for being such lazy gits and not up to soldiering, he's sitting on the bonnet. So he said, what's wrong with you then? I've got a blister on my foot. And he said, well, everybody's got blisters on their feet. But he got a lift on a jeep. I must say his standing went down very much. It never happened before. No one had ever fallen out in the platoon. But for a sergeant to fall out was just about the end of the road, as far as we were concerned. Anyway, we trudged on. And it was about this time, incidentally, that the brigadier came up and came face to face with, wearing an American field jacket and no badges of rank, I hasten to add, came face to face with the Australian water truck. And there was a little bit of a confrontation there with the water truck driver saying, this is the water truck, and the brigadier standing up in his jeep and saying, oh, this is the brigadier, and the driver put his water truck in reverse and moved up the hill and let the brigadier by. I saw this happen. I didn't hear the actual conversation going on because we were moving all the time, but some of them heard the conversation and didn't hear the beginning of it, but we were actually present at that time. And later we passed, there's a 16 field battery into a little alcove on the side. Now, we'd seen these chaps as we came up, funny enough, and I'm sure I didn't mention it, but as we were coming up, they fired a salvo and we dived into the ditch as we were just getting level with them, and they'd roar with laughter because there's nothing gunners like to frighten the poor old infantry. And when you're going forward, you're more inclined to be frightened than you are coming back, sort of thing. Eventually, we must have got to the transport. And we drove off then quite a long way to a rest area. This would be, I can't remember where the rest area was.
Capyong?
Yes, Capyong, that's right, Capyong, that's right. We passed through Capyong village and we went down the road a little bit. I don't know how many miles we went down the road. And we probably went, there are two roads come out of there, as I remember. And I expect, you know, one battalion went one way, one another. And we camped in a lovely little treed area. It was really first class area, this was. And the bivvies up, central cooking, really a fine little best harbour area we'd had for a very long time. And the company commander, who believed that we just fought our last battle, and most of us were beginning to believe that now, he said, right, now tomorrow morning the NCOs will all be up early, draw tea or coffee as the case may be, from probably coffee I expect because there wasn't much tea around, and take a bucket of tea round the bivvies, and all the private soldiers will have tea in bed in the morning. And it was quite a nice, I thought it was a nice gesture in actual fact. And the following morning, we duly got up, you know, the prowler guard woke us up early, whoever was on duty. And we went up and got these buckets of tea and took them around and called them out to get them. Some of them were so lazy they wouldn't even get out to get the tea. But after we'd been to each bivvy and, you know, served them out, or we just put the bucket in the middle there and told them to come and get it. And that was what the policy was whilst we were in this area. The NCOs got up in the morning and took a bucket of tea around to the men. I can't remember how many days we were there, probably, you know, a number of days we were there. But I think we came out on about the 17th maybe, and it would be the 23rd before anything happened. But in the meantime, we started drill parades under the RSM. The RSM had us all out, company at a time, and he picked out the ones he wanted for a guard of honour when we got back to Hong Kong, because we're now pretty sure that the war's over for us. The Argyles have been declared non-operational. We're expecting to be declared non-operational at any moment. And we start drilling about on the rough ground, and I was foolishly selected amongst all my friends that were any good for the final guard of honour, and then the RSM took us under his wing, and the CSMs took the others off and drilled them, and he drilled the guard of honour. It was quite nice, actually, to get back to a bit of proper drill again, a bit of arms drill and things like that. But of course, we had to quickly teach the KSLI how to slope arms and all the rest of it, because being a rifle chaps, they only did that quick march and trail arms and all the rest of it, you know. So we had to teach them arms drill. But they were good lads. They quickly picked it all up. And I think they were probably getting on quite well. I didn't see the training of the rest of the company, but I was with the guard, and I think we were getting quite smart, actually. Not clothing-wise, I might add, but certainly as far as drill was concerned, the RSM seemed quite pleased with us. And then on about the 21st or the 22nd, 21st I think it might have been, or 22nd, all the ammunition was drawn. I don't know, for example, if all the companies did this. B Company certainly did it. Mortars were drawn in, the bombs are drawn in, grenades, and all that was left was anybody with a LMG or a submachine gun, such as I had a Sten gun, kept one loaded magazine for the Bren, and all the riflemen kept a charged magazine, so they had 10 rounds in their magazine. And all the rest of the stuff was drawn back in. Radios were drawn back in. And that was it. As far as we were concerned, we were about to be declared non-operational, if we hadn't been already. We presume we had already, of course. And it was the following day, which would have been the 23rd, when Ken Sutton, funny enough, was the last prowler guard of the night, and he woke me up and said, there's something going on. There's the officers flying about all over the place, and CSMs have gone off, and it doesn't look too good up there. It looks a bit troublesome. So we got everybody up. By this time, I mean, we got the paler teal and we just stuck it out. We didn't go round to the bivvies. I mean, if they wanted it, they got up and had it, and they just left it there, and we all fed into it. And it all looked a bit dodgy, actually. There was platoon commanders had all gone off, although they never stayed with us when we were in rest. Platoon sergeants had gone. And I would guess it would be about, I don't know what time it was, because the day begins as soon as it's light. So we had breakfast, a central cooked breakfast. And the cooks, of course, know everything. There isn't anything a cook doesn't know, and if he doesn't know it, he'll make it up. And they said, well, it's all postponed, we're not going back to Hong Kong. We're back in the war again. And we said, oh, don't be silly, we've handled everything, we can't be. He said, yeah, well, you wait and see. And we got called then to an O group. Platoon commander came up and confirmed that we were back in the war again. Colour sergeant was dishing out all the ammunition and grenades and all the rest of it. And although not the rocket launchers and mortars, as it turned out. And he said, we're going up. The 16 field have been nearly overrun. And they've got back to a position just north of Cap Chong, and they're holding on there, and we're going up to protect them, whilst the rest of the brigade, it forms up a defensive position around. That sounded quite reasonable, really. You know, defending artillery is a fairly comfortable job. And it didn't seem a bad job at all. And I guess it was probably about, might have been midday, might have been just before midday, in actual fact. The American transport tunnel, because you appreciate it, as I've said many times before, we never had any transport sufficient to move the troops. And we climbed on, and it's funny, really, there was plenty of room on the troops, but very, very unusual, yes, you know. And we had a half a platoon on a truck, and there was plenty of room all round. Drove off, went through Cap Yong, which was looking pretty deserted by this time. And we went up to just a place, Naishon it was called. I mean, I don't think we knew the name of any of the, we knew Cap Yong, but we wouldn't have known Naishon or any of the other places along the route. and got up to where the guns were, and looking over the hood of the truck, we could see that they were pulling out onto the road. I couldn't quite make out why that was. And the column didn't stop. In fact, the guns pulled out. I mean, it might have paused, but it didn't stop. And we're going back up the Capion Valley again. I couldn't believe it. But we heard later that the rocks had said the front was stabilised, and we were going back up to give, the guns are going back up to give support. But they didn't all go. Two batteries and headquarters went. One battery, which was a very light battery, as I now know, it only had two troops of three guns, was staying behind, and you know, to assist in the defence of the brigade perimeter that was being brought up. We didn't know it, in actual fact, but in fact, there was a great big high hill there, well forward up the valley, Sulek Sound, which we should have been on, but we weren't because we were going off up with the guns. And the road wound around. We went past over a ford, and there was what looked like either a rear headquarters or maybe a storage area or something. Rocks, great big marquees, and loads of rocks milling about there, all dressed in brand new American uniforms and helmets and what have you. And we later found out, of course, that was their that was Six Rock Divisional Headquarters, but we didn't know that at the time. And it wound its way up the up the valley, and very narrow roads here, with a stream on the left. I mean, if anything broke down, you'd have to push it off, and if you couldn't push it off, it would have blocked the road. But we eventually got to a place, a little village, which we remembered from our move up north previously, and we stopped off there. The guns were in and across the valley. Right, this is, I now know it to be called Cranamni, or a name, something like that. At the time, I thought it was Karim, but I was wrong. It was a village just before Karim, you know, perhaps about 3,000 or 4,000 yards before Karim, something like that. We were the forward platoon. We were the forward company. We were the forward platoon of the forward company. And the guns spread out. They were positions which they'd occupied before, so they didn't have to do any. Gun pits were still there, such as they were. And they spread out across the valley, a very narrow valley, so they just about had room for one troop, and then another troop, and another troop, and we couldn't see behind us, obviously, but there was another, the other battery was back down there, and I think they might have had five guns across or something like that, but generally speaking, they were in line, one behind Tuller down there, and then the other battery on behind, presumably regimental 16 field headquarters in the middle, I guess. And we departed for the actual platoon was on the road, and Ken Sutton's section was put at a bend in the road, just beyond platoon HQ, which was just beyond company HQ. And I was sent with the two sections, Bill Everett and I were sent across a little stream, I don't know, 200 yards maybe, and there was a little knoll there, which we, a very nice little knoll actually, we dug in on there. And it covered forward, it covered the road, it had the best field of fire it could possibly think of. And I believe, and I've talked to many people since, and I think we were the only two sections that actually dug in on that particular day. They certainly didn't do any digging on the road, because they couldn't. And I, looking behind, I could see four platoon just up on the side of the hill there. And as far as I could tell, they'd only dug shell scrapes. I couldn't see anybody else. In fact, I couldn't see any of the other companies behind me. I really didn't know where they were. I knew they were behind, but I didn't know where they were. But in fact, I don't think any of them went up on the hills. They might have set patrols up there, but OPs up there, but they certainly didn't dig in on the hills. And we dug in well, and it was pretty quiet until the. We were running like, we were being remote from the platoon. We were a little bit of a sort of force on our own, because, and I quite like that actually, because that meant I could sort of more or less do as I like. And the platoon commander came over and had a quick look round and was satisfied with the positions. And we had to go to radio, unfortunately. And I, at that moment of time, it didn't occur to me when he first came over that it would present a problem. But just later, Bill Everett was on the duty NCO. We were doing 50% stand, LNG pits rather, not 50% stand here. We had the two LNG pits manned with two men in each, and the rest of the chaps were back behind, getting a brew up and trying to have a bit of rest and things like that, with one NCO forward as well. Bill was on duty, and he came back and he said, I'm a bit concerned. He said, up on the top of this hill, up to our left flank there, there are great big birds flying about. There are hardly any birds in Korea. In fact, the only birds I ever saw were on the Naktong, and they were similar, funny enough, flying about on a hill, which we thought they were being disturbed. Here we've got a similar thing at, on this hill up above us, flying around all over the place. Now, it might have been natural. It could have been roosting birds. But in our troubled minds, of course, we thought they were being disturbed by somebody up at the top, and a bit nervous. And it was their first time back, you'd appreciate, after 3 or 4 days, and you're always a little bit touchy at that time. So Bill said, can I take a patrol up? And I said, yeah, OK. I'll cover you from down here. You go up, take two guys, and go up. And I told him where to go. Go about halfway up. Don't go up the top. Go about halfway up, see what you can see on the what would have been his right flank, our left flank, his right flank, and then circle quite round and come back down in a big circle, but don't go to the top. So he went round, and we could see he was pretty nervous up there. He was taking it very careful, as he should have been, of course. And he circled, he went a lot farther up actually than I'd actually hoped that he would or intended him to go. Came back down again and said, I'm very dodgy up there, it doesn't look too good at all. And can I take a fighting patrol up? So I said to him, well, I'd better get permission for that, because, you know, they won't be too pleased if we send a fighting patrol out. So we sent a runner back to, or we were going to send a runner back to Platoon HQ to ask if we could send the patrol up there. And overcomes platoon commander, not at all pleased, wants to know what the hell we're doing trampling about up the hill there. And I said to him, well, we're worried about these birds on the top, and we think there's somebody up there. And went up to have a look, and the closer he got, the more concerned he was that there was some trouble. But he wasn't at all pleased with this patrol. And he said to me, well, I don't want you doing anything like that ever again. Which seemed rather peculiar, because I mean, the policy of the company was always to send out a patrol, and if you were in charge of two sections, You patrolled. I mean, you've got to know what's going on all around you. But I didn't have that. So I said to him, well, look, we've got the best vantage point that you could possibly have. We're looking down the road there. We're looking down at the front. You haven't, because your section on the road can't see for about 20 yards. But I can't tell you. I can't give you any warning. Can I have the radio? Or can I have a radio? He said, well, I'll see. He went back. I mean, he might have been told, of course, to do this by the company commander. Well, I doubt it very much, because he was very keen on patrolling. So he went back, and eventually I got a chapter 38, was it? I can't remember the number now. It might have been 18 set, the small set that the Emperor had carried. And he came over from company HQ. And as soon as he came over, I told him to get on the radio and ask him if I could send a patrol up to the top of the hill again. And they weren't too pleased. They took that fairly unkindly and said, don't come back with rubbish like that, or worse to that effect, in radio jargon, I'm sure you do. And we were watching them, and we thought, well, we aren't going to be able to do anything. But we just could not understand why no one seemed to be taking any notice of this. And Bill and I were chatting, and I said to him, well, I reckon they think that we're a bit shaky, you know, we're nervous coming back in the front line again, and our new boys are thinking that we've got the shakes on, which we hadn't. We'd settled down very, very quickly, and we all went quiet, and I said to the lads, well, you'd best get a brew up quick, and sort of tidy everything up, get everything, you know, nothing laid around, because the chances are, it looks very much to me as if